guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. At the time we began the TechNet on Lime Rock. This is TechNet number 1492, the famous year. And what the TechNet does is to gather people in the New York City area and other places that check in by EchoLink and IRLP, and amateurs teach each other. We try to tap into that brain power that we know exists in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, where this repeater has a pretty good coverage. What we're about to discover tonight is there anybody on planet Earth, on the East Coast, that's not involved in the Super Bowl? Are there hams out there? We'll soon find out if that's true. A person signs into the TechNet by getting John, Hal, Dick, and Paul, the crew, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. John is KC2WGB, Hal is K6DPZ, and Paul is WS2N. That crew tries to help people with their questions and answers. So give me a call that is right now, K2RIW listening.
KC2WGB, point of order.
With me, Paul, with a question that... Rich and yes.
KD2CMQ, Neil, yes. S2N with a space report. Good evening, everybody.
Enter Xenia with time up to bowl.
Yes, yes.
The person who just said yes, yes, who was that?
Roger that.
JC2,
Queen, Yankee Whiskey,
name here is
Joe, yes.
Yeah, so far we've got John, Rich, Joe, and Neil. But there was another person, I think the man from the Bronx. What was his call letters?
KB2, BBN.
Hey, your audio is quite low. Is that Victor Bravo November?
That's Victor Bravo November.
And your name is?
Name is Freddy. Freddy.
I should know that you checked it quite a few times before, Freddy. Okay. John, with your point of order, I know we're going to have an announcement with reference to an educational process. Is that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Correct, Dick. Name is Joe, W2BMD, educational chair with a short announcement he'd like to get that done with. And so, back to you, sir.
Okay, Joe. They're playing your song, Joe. Whiskey 2, Baker, Mike, Papa, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Good evening. First of all, I'd like to thank everybody associated, you, Dick, and everybody else associated with the TechNet. I've been listening to it for years, and I just wanted to say thank you. Incredibly educational. I learn something new every week. Limemark now has a new license upgrade system, so you can get your general tech, general extra, using instructor-led web-based, go-to-meeting type of class environment. Anybody interested, just email me, whiskey2bravomikepapa@yahoo.com. Thank you.
Joe, the classes you're speaking, when do they begin, and how long have they existed? Back to you, Joe.
The tech class will start this Tuesday. They run Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Again, they're web-based. You take the class on your computer, but it is instructor-led, and I have taught it successfully for quite a while in California and Florida. So it's new, I think, here to Limemark, but it's been very successful in the past. Back to you.
That's very good, Joe. Joe, can you make a rough estimate as to the number of people taking your class who have gone on to get the ham radio license?
I would estimate about about in excess of 300.
Only 300? Okay, only 300. But you're in the process of perfecting it, and so you intend to do better in the future. Is that true, Joe? I'm having some fun with you. Go ahead, Joe. That's amazing.
Well, the amazing thing is, since it's computer-based and we all meet on the computer, the class sizes can be larger, but I take questions individually on the subject material that they're having trouble with, and it's just a lot of fun, and this goes very quickly and very very efficiently. So I'll try to do better for you, Dick, next time around.
Very good, Joe. And from time to time, check in and let us know how that goes. First person to check in tonight with a real question or an answer. That question for the net is Rich. And Rich will discuss anything except astronomy, because that's not really ham radio. I mean, there was a man in White Plains one time, Whitestone, who said that we should always discuss ham radio subjects. I'm having some fun with Rich. Rich, go ahead and enjoy it. Astronomy is a great hobby. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, well, I know you're having fun with me, but that's okay. Yeah, I was given this week, it was a very generous gift from Greg, N2 Alpha Sierra Sierra, who's been at my house a number of times. He gave me a Mead Model 1144EQ telescope. It was a very generous gift. He bought it for his kids. His kids weren't interested. So let me let him reset. Anyway, Dick, I have a number of questions, but I'm not going to ask you all of them. First of all, I need an eyepiece. It's missing the eyepiece. Now, I think you had said, or maybe it was on the astronomy net, I'm not sure where, they have different millimeter-sized eyepieces. I wonder what you recommend. Should I buy it from me? I saw them on Amazon.com, about $20 and less. Also, I need a star chart. I saw them for $5, the ones with the rotating disc that, you know, you set, you know what I'm talking about. My father used to get them for me at the Hayden Planetarium. I think it's got north, south, east, and west, and you rotate a disc for the time of the year. The other thing is John KC2WGD. John had recommended I get a Mercator map of the sky. I didn't see one on Amazon.com. So those are some of the questions I had. That I want to set this thing up and in the spring be able to use it. I'm learning how to find the North Star. That's another thing. I don't think I'll be able to see the North Star from here. What is it, like 14 degrees above the horizon? And I think I've got trees in that direction. Back to that, N2EO.
Yeah, I'm reasonably sure the North Star is a lot more than 14 degrees above the horizon. Let's see, it would have to be the inverse of your and my latitude, 41 degrees away from 50 some odd degrees. It's 50 some odd degrees above your northern horizon is the North Star. And the North Star does not change. Every other star changes. From you and my point of view, the whole sky rotates around the North Star. It would appear, if you took a time-lapse photography around the North Star, you would watch the whole sky appear to rotate counterclockwise from your point of view. Mead's a very good brand name of a telescope. And when it comes to eyepieces, guarantee you Mead makes a whole lot of them, and Mead maybe is going to be a little bit more pricey, and is the actual dollars worth it? There, I'm not sure. One of the other places you should check is the Orion catalog. If you Google the word Orion, or just do a search on Orion, they've got a very nice catalog. I promised to send you one a couple of weeks ago. I went and looked for some of my catalogs, and apparently they got thrown out. So they usually mail one to me every month or so, because I was buying products from them, but I haven't bought things from them for about a year. Maybe they've stopped. picking up three different diameters that are popular. I think 7/8 of an inch, but I'm not sure, is an unpopular small size. 1¼, I believe, is the one that's most popular in diameter. And for the really serious telescopes, they also make eyepieces of 2 inches in diameter. So your first requirement is to find out what diameter eyepiece you need. The next requirement is to figure out how many millimeters you want. The smaller the number of millimeters on the eyepiece, the more the magnification. But be careful. You don't want too much magnification right away. Measure the number of inches, or by one means or another, you'll find the number of inches of diameter of the front of your telescope, and multiply that by 60. If it was, for instance, 2-inch diameter telescope, multiplied by 60 would be 120. You don't want to go above 120 in magnification. In fact, you don't even really want to go there. Maybe half that number is more than enough. You go beyond that to 60 times the number of inches, and you just get a blurry picture. It's not really useful. A lot of people fall into that trap. Guarantee we have some other people who have some astronomy experience listening to us right now. So anybody who would make some further suggestions for an eyepiece for Rich, I'll pass it over to you in a minute. One other thing you want to get a hold of is an astrolabe. I think it's the name of the thing. That plastic star chart, which has got a rotating perimeter to it. We dial in the month of the year, and you dial in the hour that you're observing, and it'll show you what the sky looks like.
Planisphere.
Hey, Jerry, Jay. Okay, John and Eric recognized. Astrolabe is what I think it's called. Star chart is another thing it can be called. Barnes & Noble is the one where I bought a nice large one recently from the Barnes & Noble store. So you would never think that you could buy a thing like that there. Let's see. I'm going to pass it over to John and then Eric in that order for further information.
Repeater, time out.
Dick, last time I bought mine, it came in, it was labeled Planisphere. Just something perfect to look for.
Very fine, John. So Planisphere. I thought mine was called a astrolabe, but there I'm not sure. Eric, KE2EJ. Glad you're back. K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, K2RIW, KE2EJ. Two things. One, you're still in the Stone Age. If you happen to have a smartphone, there's a number of apps that you can download for free. Actually, one's called The Sky, another one's called The Planet. When you take your phone, you point it up to the sky, and you have it all set correctly, it will actually show you the segment of the sky that you're looking at, show you the constellations. You have the option of turning the constellations on, lines on and off. You can turn the MESA objects on and off. You can turn the planets on and off. And you can even look below the horizon to see what's coming up. Very, very smart devices. Very accurate, too. And actually, when you click on a particular star, it'll give you its name and its history and who discovered it and that kind of stuff. And when you're clicking on MESA objects, it'll actually show you what the object looks like if you don't happen to have a telescope to look at it with. That's one thing. And in terms of an ocular for the gentleman, I probably would recommend something like a Times 10 and keep a Barlow handy. And that should pretty much do the trick. K2RIW, K2J.
Matt Dick?
Yeah, thank you very much, Eric. John, go ahead.
Dick, what Eric is recommending is great stuff, but he's learning. He should learn about the inclination, declination, the azimuth, right ascension, sidereal time. He's got to read about that, and he can only do that with a physical star chart to do it properly so he can learn how to calculate positions and times. Then he can take the shortcut to the phone. Just a comment.
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing. It gives you all that information if you're too lazy to work it out yourself.
Learn how to calculate it.
Yeah, there's at least two schools of thought here. Let me drop this. Some people will buy a telescope that has a so-called go-to characteristic to it, where you just go down the list on the screen of the telescope, the computer, and say, I want to look at that star, and zip-zip, the motors turn, and it goes there. Other people say, hey, that's not astronomy. You haven't learned how to do it. One of the things that you noticed that Eric mentioned is a Barlow lens. Barlow is a kind of a lens that you stack in between your eyepiece and the rest of the telescope. that it multiplies the eyepiece by either 2 or by 3. It multiplies the gain by 2 or by 3. So therefore, with a Barlow lens, whatever number of eyepieces you've got just become doubled. So once you finally calculate what size eyepiece you would like to have for your first and your second, in other words, how many millimeters of the eyepiece focal length, which determines the gain of the scope, and it works kind of backwards. You take the focal length of the rest of the telescope divided by the focal length of the eyepiece, and that's the gain you're going to get, the times magnification. And so choosing the right eyepiece diameter, choosing the right eyepiece millimeters for the right amount of gain, and the next thing you're going to look at, if you're smart enough, is what is the apparent field of view. Each eyepiece, depending on its design, has a certain number of degrees of field of view. A really terrible one would have 30 degrees of field of view, and it's like looking down a straw. And a really good one would have 90 degrees field of view, and it's like, you know, walking into space and looking all around, so to speak. Let me drop. Yeah, Nagler is a brand name that has really super wide field of view, but they've also got super high prices. So there's a trade-off there for field of view, millimeters, quality of lens, whether or not it gives distortion out at the perimeter, reading the right progress report, now, the right report, now, what would you call it now, technical report on the lens, if you really want to dig into it before investing your money. But almost everybody with a telescope owns 2, 3, or 4 eyepieces eventually. There are times when you want a lot of magnification, there are times when you don't want a lot of magnification. Also, depending on the design of your particular telescope, you might want an erecting prism, in other words, a prism that makes the picture look right side up instead of upside down, so to speak. When you're looking at the sky upside down, it's not much of a problem. But I like using a telescope for terrestrial observing, particularly the top of my tower. The next time I climb, I want to know what wrench I got to bring with me, if you know what I mean. So this is some of the information you're looking for. Do get a hold of an Orion catalog. I'm going to take another look because I got one of the plates where I maybe have got one for you, Rich. And two, Echo Oscar, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2LAW, TechNet, Limelock, N2EO. A little bit confused. Nobody's fault, but I'm getting thrown a lot of information at once. I guess I kind of feel like a guy who just bought a Collins or a Kenwood and is just saying, how do I put it on the air, you know? What I'm going to do, my cousin Amy, who's been very helpful to me, very helpful, she said anything I need, not just astronomy, but anything, to send her an email, and she would get it for me and mail it to me. She works in Manhattan. I wonder if she, I don't know what they call it now. I think they call it the Guggenheim Planetarium, but what used to be the Hayden Planetarium. I'm sure if she went there, they would help her out. She works in Midtown Manhattan. Dad does it.
And to have a whole lot of questions in the beginning, Rich, is very normal. And you're entering a brand new field that you haven't gotten very deep into in the past. And so to be confused in the beginning is normal. Don't let that upset you, if you know what I mean. Just keep asking questions. There's lots of websites that will help an awful lot. Sky and Telescope is one of them. You read the early chapters. When you go to the website of Sky and Telescope, and they've been around for 150 years, they'll tell you an awful lot about what it's like to have your first telescope or binoculars and what you should be doing with it. And they've got articles that'll explain some of this. I've got a particular book, which is my favorite introduction to astronomy. I'll eventually, maybe in the next half hour or so, if there's a little bit of free time where I can walk around the house while somebody's expressing a question, I'll pick up a copy of the book and I'll tell you what you should be looking for. Baker is the author, as I remember, B-A-K-E-R, and as I remember, the ninth edition is a good one, but unfortunately it's a little bit hard to find on the used book store. But it's one of my favorite books that, in good language with some nice diagrams, really shows you an awful lot about what astronomy is, how to use telescopes, and so on. Also, the Orion Catalog, let me drop this. The Orion Catalog, although it's the main purpose of the catalog is to sell on the way various telescopes work and so on. So it's a good source of information as well as a place to buy things. So good luck with that project, Rich, and check in with us periodically. Joe is the next person, KC2QIW, all the way up there in Harrison, New York. That's a nice long haul. So go right ahead, Joe. KC2QIW, KQIW, the TechNet.
Dick, last thing, if you didn't mention, I wanted you to mention, would the planetarium in Manhattan be able to guide my cousin if she gave them the model number of the telescope to get the right stuff for me? Over.
If by one means or another you get the owner's manual on that telescope where you've got a particular model number and an extremely good brand, Celestron are the two most popular brands in the United States, in my opinion. So one means or another, you're going to get the owner's manual on that exact telescope from Mead, and I bet you can do a download online. That's going to give you a lot of information in a hurry for that particular telescope. To go to the Hayden Planetarium with a question like that, unless you talk to a person who is familiar with that particular scope, I'm not sure that's the most direct approach, if you know what I mean, Rich. Back to you, Rich. KQLIW.
No comment.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, I believe there's a Mead users group on YouTube. I'm sure you can glean a lot of information from that. More so, Hayden is not going to be able to help unless he runs into a scope aficionado up there who may be able to direct him to different stores, but they're not going to have that information.
Yeah, it looks like John and I are in agreement on this one. So although the Rose Center of the Hayden Planetarium, part of the Museum of Natural History, great place to go to the telescope, to a astronomy show, if you know what I mean, to learn an awful lot about astrophysics. But to ask them questions on a particular model number of a particular telescope, that might not be the best way. Owner's manual and the users group, guarantee you're going to find a lot of information there. And also, as I said, the website for Sky and Telescope magazine. The most frequent question they get is, what should my first telescope be and how should I use it? And so they've got a number of introductory articles on that website that will help you, Rich. Okay, let's go over to Joe, KC2QIW. Go right ahead, Joe, with your question. KQIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Roger, that with the famous four beeps. Quick question. The International Space Station, the International Space Station, I was wondering, do they have a amateur radio equipment on board over there? Because I was on YouTube and I saw a 30-minute tour on YouTube, and I'm assuming that she forgot to mention her amateur radio equipment. That's my question. Back to the next.
Yeah, they may not only have a amateur radio station, they may have more than one. A significant number of amateurs have contacted the International Space Station at various times. A significant number of the astronauts do have a ham license, and in their free time, they're allowed to use that equipment. I'm reasonably sure if you go to the website of American Radio Relay, the ARRL.org, and you dial in ISS as a search word, I think you'll get some information that way. Let's see if anyone else online, right now, online with us, if you know what I mean, knows more specifics about the International Space Station, ham radio equipment. There are a significant number of high schools and grade schools, for instance, where about four times per year at least, those schools will contact the ISS. They're given an opportunity. They're told when it will be flying over their school, and that window of time is made available to them, and they talk to an astronaut. And so a number of schools on Long Island have done that. So anybody within the sound of my voice with some further information about contacting the ISS and the ham station, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, it's your Jack
Glenn.
Okay, I heard K2EJ and Glenn. Go ahead, Eric, first.
I just wanted to mention that a club which sponsors this TechNet has actually successfully done a, from the Cradle of Aviation, a contact to the ISS. Initially, it was going to be done with ham radio, 2 meters, and that was set up, but then what happened? We had a snowstorm, I think it was, and they did it at a later date, but utilizing the facilities of the TV. So, by the way, a good site to go is to amsec.org. You get lots of information, along with the DARRO website. So, back to you, Dick.
K2MVR with a comment. MVR recognized. And we got Glenn right ahead of you, sir. Okay, AMSAT, Amateur Satellite Corporation, another source of information along with ARRL. The person who said Glenn, and maybe that was KC2QIQ, go right ahead, Glenn, K2RIW, the TechNet. The person who said Glenn, who was that? Okay, maybe nobody. K2MVR, start with your name, sir, and your comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hello, Dick, and everybody in the net listening. This is Joe, K2MBR, mobile in the Bronx. Yeah, I just want to comment on the International Space Station. Last time I contacted them was with Packet, APRS. I don't know if the gentleman's familiar with APRS, but that was pretty cool to track the ISS with AMSAT. You go to AMSAT.org, and they have a tracking software, and you could track it, and you can contact it via APRS, which is pretty cool. So that's another way of reaching them. Just my 2 cents. Back to you, K2RW, K2MVR.
US2N. Thank you very much, Joe. And Paul recognized, get to you in a second, Paul. For those who want to look at the QRZ.com listing for K2 Mike Victor Romeo, you'll see some very nice pictures. And I can tell that Joe is a dog lover. Very nice picture of him and his dog with top hats. Well done, Joe. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, what Eric said is that going to AMSAT is the best idea. They'll give you the frequencies and all. And they have a station on Discovery, part of the space station, the American side, and one on the Russian side. I believe they actually have it now in the Zarya module. They have 2 meter antennas outside and all, 440. Quite a few of them outside by now. So, I think the one on the Kenwood is a Kenwood on the American side. I'm not sure what the Russians have, but they interact. You know, a Russian will use an American one back and forth. They all have their call signs. And this has been going on since the space stations, anyways. Mir had it, and one of the video tour of the space station was by Suni Williams. She was the commander a couple of years ago of the space station, and she gave a real good tour, about a half hour long. It's probably the best one I've ever seen. Wonder if that was the one that he saw. Back to you there, Dick, WS2N.
Thank you, Paul. Some more good information. Anyone else with any further information about ham radio contacting to the International Space Station? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening. Okay. The guy who asked the question was Queen Yankee Whiskey. I think I heard from you again. Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay. Dick and the group, I have to tell you that, like I said, when I saw the tour on the YouTube, I forgot our name. you know, when I first clicked on it, you know, I thought it was like a Hollywood setup. I thought it was fake. But then I was like, wow, okay, so that's the real deal. So I was watching it, the whole thing. And then, you know, I wrote on YouTube, I wrote her, you forgot to mention the amateur radio equipment, amateur radio, and so I'm just waiting for her response. I just did this last night, late last night. So I'll let you guys know next week if she responds to me. You know, I watched the whole video, like I said, and it was a really good tour. Nice. First time I ever saw that. All right, so I'll pass it over to the other station out there, and thank you for the help.
Has to be SUNY Williams. It's got to be.
Sounds good, Paul and Joe. And do come back, Joe, and let us know what you find out. Fun subject. And to take a picture of the International Space Station, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do, because it's moving 17,500 miles an hour. It's at a relatively low altitude. So it goes, if the shot was directly over your house, in other words, if that particular pass lines up that way, horizon to horizon is like 18 minutes, so it happens real fast. There are lots of people who, with the proper kind of a filter in front of their telescope, with the right kind of a camera connected to the telescope, will take a picture of the International Space Station as it passes across the surface of the sun. And that gives you an extremely high contrast silhouette of the International Space Station. That's the good news. The bad news, you go through the mathematics of that, and you find out that it whips across the half degree of the sun in roughly one quarter of a second. So you've got to have a very carefully timed camera, if you know what I mean. The average person does it as a movie, so to speak, 16 frames per second, if you can do it, and a couple of those frames will catch the International Space Station as it whips across the sun. But if you go to the right website, you'll find some beautiful pictures people have taken. But the technology required there to take that kind of a shot is not easy. Okay, let's go over to Neil, KD2, Charlie Mike, Quebec. Neil, you live in Glen Oaks, which is a real TX contact between you and the repeater, which is in Glen Oaks. I'll bet you could put out a microwatt of signal and you'd be getting into this repeater. K2, KD2, CM2, K2RIW. You got it, Neil.
Yes, Dick, you're right. Last time we talked, I went on my Baofeng at lowest power, and we didn't have any problem from my basement. However, I wanted to ask you today about receive antennas. One of the projects that I'm going to be working on will give me a general receive, wideband receiver that should go somewhere from around DC to 2 gig. And I'm looking probably at putting up a disc cone antenna for it. But I wanted to ask you about tuning it. I get two views. One is that you don't need a tuner. The other is that you do. But and reciprocity, if I understand it correctly, that if you can hear somebody, you can transmit to them, and in order to transmit to them, you need to be resonant, would indicate that you need to tune the antenna for the frequency you're at. And I'd like your opinions on that. Thank you.
6DPZ with comments.
Okay. This is one where Hal, with his experience, could quite possibly give us a brief answer. Go right ahead, Hal. K6, Delta Papa Zulu, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. Yeah, as far as the disc cone goes, the only limiting factor is the range of the disc cone. If you design a disc cone, it will go from, let's say, 30 megs to biggest, lowest frequency of 30 megs. It'll go all the way up to your UHF frequency. And it's broadband. You don't have to worry about tuning it. See, the signal into it, the signal will radiate. It's like an open waveguide, which Dick can explain more about that. That's my fast and quickie answer. Don't sweat tuning it. Just jam a signal into it.
and antennas, Neil. Disc cone is probably one of the broadest that's popular. A number of them are sold. Building one homebrew is not too difficult. And a tremendous frequency region is possible. The only other antenna I know that has a very wide frequency region is a log periodic. And log periodic is directional. Almost all disc cones are used in a way where they're vertically polarized, which is ideal for FM repeater work. And the so-called broad bandwidth of a disc cone usually means, let me pick a number, better than 2.5 to 1, maybe better than 3 to 1 standing wave ratio across all of its rated frequency region. And in the case of an HF antenna, a 2.5 or 3 to 1 visoir is not good enough on a no-tune. No-tune rig needs a 1.5 visoir or better in many cases, but that's 80 through 10 meters. Most VHF rigs are pretty forgiving. And even if your particular disc cone on your particular favorite frequency, which maybe is going to be 50 megs, 144, 430, 440 megs, and whatever, if on that particular region it has a little higher visoir than you like, and an antenna analyzer or a standing wave ratio meter will let you find that out pretty fast. Making it have a better visoir at that particular frequency, lots and lots of ways of doing that. Let me drop and I'll explain reciprocity. If you are putting an antenna in an anechoic chamber and you are measuring everything you wanted to know about the antenna, gain, beam width, front to back ratio, polarization characteristics, and whatever, the law of reciprocity says whether you're using the antenna under test as a receiving device or whether you're using it as a transmitting device, all of the data you measure will be the same. It doesn't matter. It's I guess you could say it's a little bit like your coaxial cable. Your coaxial cable, do you worry about if you're using it for transmitting or for receiving? The cable doesn't know the difference. Whether the signal flows up or flows back down, it's essentially the same. An antenna is like that. A little hard to believe. You'd be amazed how many times you'll hear somebody on 20 meters spouting his particular theory where this antenna transmits well but doesn't have very much effective capture area. He'll say things like that. Well, there's a direct relationship between transmitter gain and capture area when you're receiving. So reciprocity means that there is no difference, with rare exception. And the exception would be an antenna that has an amplifier built into it. So this cone is a very good beginning. And later on, you may try other kinds of antennas for your particular kind of reception and or transmission. But a good broadband service, like you're going to put your scanner on an antenna, this cone is a very good place to start, from my point of view, Neil. And you're allowed to come back and ask more questions on this subject. KD2, Charlie Mike, Quebec, K2LAW in the TechNet.
So what you're saying is I don't need to tune it to a specific frequency if I'm listening to that frequency. Over.
Yeah, when you read the data sheet, if you're buying a popular brand name of disc cone antenna, usually they will give you a chart of standing wave ratio versus frequency. It's an XY plot. And you'll know what the standing wave ratio is going to be on that antenna. And until the antenna exceeds some huge number, let me think, I think it's roughly 5 to 1. 5 to 1 standing wave ratio is the place where you lose half the power, 3 dB if you're transmitting or receiving. You lose 3 dB on reception if it's a pure 50 ohm receiver. The average ham radio operator will lose a whole lot of sleep if his antenna exceeds 2 to 1. When it comes to real decibels of loss, 2 to 1 is half a dB of loss. It's a little more than the width of your signal strength meter, if you know what I mean. So we over-worry about that. And we got into that over-worry because of the so-called no-tune transmitters, many of which will go into a self-protect mode when you exceed 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio. So no tuning is required. Without a doubt, the antenna is extremely broadband. However, if this is the best of all worlds, let me drop it. If this is the best of all worlds, you would like the antenna to operate from 3 megacycles to 300 megacycles or 3,000 megacycles inclusive and have a standing wave ratio no more than 1.2 to 1 across that frequency region. That would be the best of all worlds. Well, that's a dream. It doesn't exist, with rare exception. So disc cone antennas cover a lot of frequency. cover a lot of frequency, but they do have peaks of VSWR at certain frequencies where you're going to see numbers like 2.5 and 3 to 1. Don't let that make you lose a lot of sleep. And a receiver, with rare exception, is extremely forgiving. You can take a radio piece of clip lead that's obviously the wrong length, a couple of feet long, connect it to the center conductor of your receiver, and start listening to any band you want, and you'll get some beautiful reception. Receivers are very forgiving. To transmit back through that particular piece of clip lead, where the standing wave ratio might be 500 to 1, no, that's not going to work very well, because the transmitter doesn't like it. If the transmitter could continue to operate, somebody would still hear you. You're just not going to do a great DX that way. So don't let the standing wave ratio scare you when you're doing reception. And when it comes to VHF equipment, most of them are very forgiving. I think the average 2-meter and 440 transmitter, if it looked into a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio, would continue to operate. It's not the ideal way, but it will continue to operate. It doesn't necessarily go into a self-protect mode. Maybe that helps. KD2, or CM2, K2LIW, go ahead, Neil.
And so we are with some information.
Now, let me go to Neil first. Go ahead, Neil.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dick. As always, you've given me some very good, precise information, and I think I have what I need. But I'd like to hear any other comments that are out there. Over.
Yeah, I think you've owned a
repeater. Time out.
As I was starting to say, I think you've owned a Discone antenna. Is that true, Rich? And if so, tell us your experience with it. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet. Wait for the 4 beeps.
Yeah, you've got a good memory, Dick. That's quite a number of years ago in Whitestone. Yes, I had the ICOM makes a Discone. You wouldn't think so, but they do. And it's all stainless steel. I believe it was stainless steel. It's a very fine antenna, from 30 megs up to it's 2 gigs or higher. Radio Shack also makes one for less money, but I would stay away from the Radio Shack antennas in general. I had not a Discone, but something else from Radio Shack in an antenna. It was horrible. The construction was horrible. Back to then, N2EO.
Yeah, one of the most famous broadband receivers is the ICOM R7000 series, R7000, 7100, and so on, where the R7000, for instance, tunes from 25 megs to 2000 inclusive, and when you read the owner's manual, one of their recommendations is the ICOM Discone antenna to go with that. So now the antenna is essentially equally as broad as that scanner receiver, and that receiver listens to all modes, and it's pretty nice. In fact, I'm using one right now. When I'm running full duplex, I'm using an ICOM R7000, while at the same time I'm transmitting with a Kenwood 711 into a Yagi antenna. Now, Discone is probably, with the exception of log periodic or rhombic, it's about the most broadband antenna of popular design. I know of an antenna that's a little bit more broadband, a so-called Talbar antenna. The good news is the Talbar has got a very good standing wave ratio and super broadband. The bad news is it's got very low gain by comparison to a Discone. It's essentially a leaky dummy load resistor, if you know what I mean. There literally is a 50-ohm resistor on a Talbar antenna. And for those who don't know it, there are 5,000 kinds of antennas. The average electrical engineering student coming fresh out of a good school where he has studied communications electronic engineering as a subject. And he comes before me because he's applying for a job, and I'm one of the people that were occasionally assigned the job of doing an interview of new people. And I would quite often ask the guy, how many kinds of antennas do you think there are? And the school led him to believe that maybe there's 20 or 30 kinds. You can bend wires in a couple of different ways, they would think. As I said, from my point of view, there were 5,000. Not everyone's going to agree with that. Some of those antennas will...
Repeater, time out.
I've done that a lot tonight. Looks like we've got a fairly short timer we've got to worry about. So, schools have led the average student to believe there are very few intents. Not everyone's going to agree with me when I say 5,000. Depending on your point of view, you would say a log periodic and a Yagi are different antennas. To me, they're very different, even though they have some similarity in the theory of operation. But there's a large number of them. And there's a whole series of antennas that you would never even see. Every slot in the sheet metal of an automobile, where the fender meets the rest of the car, you put a small insulator there and paint it over, you could make an antenna out of that. There are law enforcement vehicles where the side view mirror is the antenna, or the loudspeaker in the back of the near the rear window is the antenna. You can, if you're smart enough, you can make an antenna out of anything. And antennas, believe it or not, the inverse of an antenna is something that very few people know about. The average antenna, like a dipole, is a piece of wire in the insulation of free space. Let me drop.
A6DPZ, comment.
Now recognize. So starting to say, a dipole is a conductor inside of an insulator free space. You can do the exact opposite. Start off with a sheet of metal that's very conductive and cut a slot in it where the dipole would be. It's the exact inverse. In other words, where you had a conductor, you make an insulator. Where you had an insulator, you make a conductor. You get the exact same gain and the exact same pattern with that so-called slot antenna in a sheet of metal that I just described. The only thing different is that one is horizontal and the other is vertically polarized. But you'd be amazed how many kinds of antennas. I bet you worked on some pretty wild antennas over the days, Hal. K6DPZ, KQRIW, go right ahead.
RIW and TechNet, K6DPZ. Well, I was just going to mention the DDR antenna, which is a very low-profile antenna for the top of a roof of a vehicle, and it has phenomenal characteristics. I'm sure you can fill it in on it, Dick.
Yeah, DDRR stands for Directional Discontinuity Ring Radiator. The good news is it's an extremely compact antenna with nice performance. The bad news is it's very narrow band, with rare exception. There's ways you could put a terminating resistor on it and use it sort of like a log periodic, like a rhombic, and you could make it broadband, but you'd be sacrificing a whole lot of gain. So DDRR is not necessarily a broadband antenna. Very compact, yes. So for Neil's particular performance, which I think he's looking for right now, I wouldn't recommend that particular one. Although, do study it. Interesting antenna. Now, when it comes to antennas, Neil, if you make an investment and study the various kinds and their characteristics, how to tune them and learn them. And you said something very poignant before. Let me drop it. I'm going to change the wording a little bit when it comes to transmitting antennas, where we usually describe a transmitting antenna as something that has, let's call it 90% efficiency or greater. Rarely are you going to build an antenna with 1% transmitting efficiency for a whole bunch of reasons. However, depending on where you are frequency-wise and what you're doing with it, a 1% efficient receiving antenna could be perfectly adequate. So when it comes to transmitting antennas, where you want something like 90% efficiency and 100 if you can get it, the rule of thumb is you resonate first, then you can radiate. And so all the elaborate things you do with a tuning network and with a transmission line, impedance matching devices and whatever on an antenna is to force it into electronic resonance. Once the antenna is resonant at your particular frequency, and there's a bunch of definitions of what that means, then with rare exception, it's going to radiate like gangbusters. So resonate first, then you can radiate. An extremely basic, very good piece of information, not written in any antenna book that I know about. Craziness. That tells me that the people who write antenna books only have partial understanding of the subject they're writing about. Good subject, Neil. You'll have to come back and ask more about it. KD2CM2, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, actually, Dick, the R7000, I'm just waiting for it to get here. I recently purchased one used, and between that and the SDR stuff I've been trying to put together, like I said, I should cover DC to 2000 gig. Do you have any comments on, is there modifications I need to do to the 7000? Thank you.
is coming.
People who don't yet have a ham license or don't have the equipment by which they can go
up to us live. They send him pigeon dropping, snail mail, emails, whatever, with their questions. And sometimes you get some really good ones. I can tell that some of these up-and-coming hams are going to be darn good scientists. KC2WGV, K2RAW, go ahead, John.
We are with a comment.
Before I get out of here. Did you say, Hal, you have a comment before you get out of here? Rich, I recognize you. Go ahead, Hal, is that what you said?
Correct. Dick, do not try to go into that radio without the shop service manual. Just the operating manual is not sufficient, and if you need information from the shop service manual, I'll be more than happy to share it with you.
Okay, good offer. Go ahead, Rich, wait for the beeps.
Okay, fine, Dick. I just wanted to ditto what Hal said about insurance. I think most of the guys on this frequency know that my former girlfriend cleaned me out. She sold all my ham gear, which was about $10,000 worth. And, for not having the insurance. Had I had the ARRL insurance, I would have gotten paid on all your stuff. Not just an R7000, on everything. Back to net, N2EO.
Okay, I think I'm hearing somebody with a late chicken. It sounded like AC2IS, I'm not sure. And the audio is extremely low, so give us as much audio as you can and go right ahead with your late chicken. AC2IS, question mark, I think it's you, Bill, K2LAW. Very fine. Who was it, the person that said late check-in? Give me your call letters and name.
Andy, KD2ESY.
Okay, Andy, KD2ESY. Go right ahead, Andy.
Just checking in later. Sorry, I've been tied up at home, but I want to check in for the tech net tonight.
Andy, do you have a question?
Right now, I do not have a question. I was very interested in what Rick had to say about the insurance, though. I think that's an important issue.
Very fine, Andy. Okay, late check-in. By the way, we do not take check-ins on the TechNet just because people are listening. We used to do that in the old days, and it took them a whole lot of time. We make sure that only the people who do have a question or a comment check in. TechNet has been around now for 1,492. This is 1492, the 1,492 version of the TechNet for the last 30 or so years. Believe it or not, the total number of hours that the TechNet has been on the air is greater than the total number of hours that Johnny Carson has been on the air in the 30 years that he was on NBC television for the Tonight Show. Crazy numbers. I think it's close to a record. And so, John, continuing the record, go right ahead with your mailbag. And did you get any of these guys with some brand new ideas? Let's find out. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Well, everyone on the net. Yeah, we got a few questions. It's been rather slow, I guess, because of the bowl game and the weather. People are starting to hibernate. Let me see. First, I'd like to check and see if Glenn is on to continue a question from last week. KC2QIQ, if you're out there. Apparently not. Okay, then I'll go on to the other question. All right, I have a young amateur that's trying to understand, maybe with a little more explanation, you can explain it to him a little better than he has right now.